He stood with Ilford and Fault on the rocks at the far end of Alcatraz Island, just above the lapping edge of the water. The sky was sensationally blue and clear, the air cold. The abandoned prison made Everett think of the Vacaville maze. And the ocean, visible through the bracket of the Golden Gate Bridge, marked the end of his journey west. It was another desert, but not one he could cross in a stolen car. After the rain, Fault and Ilford had driven him across the city and then taken him in a boat to the island, not explaining why. Everett felt that they both wanted to leave Cale, the memory or the fact of him, behind at the house. But Cale was alive in his father's features, so much that Everett flinched at the sight of it. Couldn't Fault see this too? A seagull wheeled over the rocks and foam and into the middle of their view, then flew in place there against the wind, wings straining, feathers flattened, making no particular progress. "How long were you in Hatfork?" Ilford asked suddenly. Everett was surprised at the question, but he knew the answer. "At least 5 years." "It's been less than 2 years since the break," said Ilford. "I was in Hatfork for 5 years." Ilford and Fault exchanged a look. The seagull turned in the direction of the wind and disappeared. "You said the cars there ran on gas?" said Ilford. "Yes. Wouldn't it have broken down chemically in the tanks?"
"He's right, Everett," said Fault. "Gas doesn't stay good that long."
What did it matter if more holes were poked in his reality? Yet he felt Chaos's 5 years in Hatfork as a part of him, a limb. Those years had happened to someone, somewhere. "Okay," he said. "2 years. 2 years since what?"
"Sorry?"
"When you say the break, what do you mean?"
"There's no one explanation, Everett. People remember some kind of disaster, but there's no agreement on what it was. You've seen that firsthand more than any of us have."
How did Ilford know, Everett wondered. He told his story to Cale, no one else. Not Fault, and certainly not Ilford.
Do my dreams reveal that much? Or was he talking to Cale now?
Everett stole another glance at Ilford, who stood staring off at the sea, but trying to sort out the blurred features of father and son only gave him a headache. Fault saw him looking and grinned ruefully, as if to say, "Don't bother."
"You're like Kellogg, you know," said Ilford.
"What does that mean?" Everett blurted, though the accusation was all too familiar. Melinda, Kellogg himself. Maybe Ilford got his information direct from Kellogg, thought Everett sourly. That would account for a lot.
"You're one of the ones that make things happen, make things the way they are. Hatfork, Little America, that was as much your work as Kellogg's."
"I'm the opposite," protested Everett. "I'm a universal antenna. Whatever the local concept, I fall for it."
"You're receiving, but you're also sending, warping the local concept."
Everett recalled the food in Hatfork, the soup made from dogs and cats. The idea that he might have been responsible for the way people lived there made him feel physically ill. "Nuclear fear was Kellogg's obsession. That wasn't my disaster."
"Your influence is subtle."
"Weak is the word for it."
"You've been unaware of your ability. That's the only limitation."
"I'd rather stay unaware of it." They fell silent, staring together out over the ocean.
"Why did you come here, Everett?"
Ilford asked. Everett didn't reply.
"He's looking for a girl, Ilford," said Billy Fault. "A particular girl."
"A girl?" Ilford repeated skeptically. Everett wanted to ask Ilford if he knew Gwen, but stopped himself, remembering his promise to Fault not to speak of the vials in the refrigerator, of Cale.
"You're too fixated on the past," said Ilford. You can't go back, especially when you're changing things as you go along. You can't reclaim a thing that changes as you touch it. Everett wanted to ask, what about Kale? Who touched him and made him change? Because it wasn't me. He turned away from the water, towards the massive, ruined prison. It loomed against the bright sky like a gnarled face. He began picking his way up across the rocks to the concrete embankment that bordered the island. Ilford and Fault went after him. Back at the pier, they got back in the boat and cruised out into the bay in silence. Everett felt tiny and vulnerable in the boat, chafed by the wind and sun, the water beneath them a bottomless mystery. He thought of Kellogg's dream of the ocean, of the desert's reversion to water. A dream of longing, it seemed to him now. The earth itself was unchangeable, the endless tracts of sand and water and pavement. It was the people, the perturbable madmen who roamed its surface, who viewed the world as transient and broken. Everett wished the earth could somehow reach up and still them, the crazy people, and invest them with its silence and permanence and depth. "I'd like to go in the opposite direction," he said suddenly to Ilford. "I'd rather find a way to stop the dreams." "You don't have to choose. You could make the world and your dreams fit together." "Then I would be like Kellogg," said Everett, "or one of the others, the ones who run Vacaville. You don't want that here." He didn't say that he thought No Alley was already under some subtle control, that things in San Francisco were oddly wrong. "It doesn't have to be like that," said Ilford. He sat at the wheel, steering carelessly, bumping the boat over the waves towards the glittering margin of the city. "There'll be a little party at the house tonight. Talk to my friends." He went into the kitchen first, avoiding the party, and lost himself in the splendor of Ilford's food. After 5 years of starvation, at least he remembered 5 years of starvation, the bounty was intoxicating. He blundered past the spread on the counter into the cupboard, looking for dishes. Instead, he found stores that would have fed the little Americans for a month, shelves loaded with cans, not raw staples like beans or soup stock, but delicacies, pimentos, tiny fish and mustard, pickled asparagus and hearts of palm. He forgot to eat, began exploring out of fascination. One cabinet was loaded with bottles of the scotch Ilford had served the night before, another with flasks of balsamic vinegar, jars of roasted red peppers, and bags of macadamia nuts. A freezer on the floor was squeezed full of enormous cuts of beef and lamb. He moved back through the kitchen in a daze, piled up a cartoonish plate of cold meats and salad at the counter, and took it out to the living room. The small knot of people seemed dwarfed in the glow of Ilford's house, and the murmur of their conversation echoed softly as though it were being absorbed into the furnishings of the room. Outside, the fog had closed up to the windows again. How had they gotten here? Everett wondered. Where had they come from? It was as if Ilford had stocked his place with guests from some storage area and stuck them into place around the chairs and sofa like candles into a holder. "Dawn Crash," said a woman, inserting herself in front of him and sticking out her hand. She was Ilford's age and Ilford's type. Well-preserved, too fit for her years, the flesh of her face seamless and well-tanned, her posture unnaturally upright, her eyes threateningly bright and eager. Everett found her incredibly attractive. "Hey, Dawn," said Billy Fault, slipping between them. "Hello, Billy. Introduce me to your friend." Everett set his plate on the coffee table, shook her hand, and told her his name. He had the feeling it wasn't a surprise. The woman pressed closer, her stance excluding Fault. "I thought it was you. Ilford says you're staying for a while."
"Maybe."
"Good. Perhaps we'll be working together." She was interrupted by the arrival of Ilford and another man, who, with his shaved head and heavy black glasses, reminded Everett of the mad doctor in a movie he'd seen on Edie's television. The doctor in the movie had been apprehended by President Kentman himself in a thrilling shootout at a gas station. "Harriman, this is Everett Moon," said Ilford. "Everett, meet Harriman Crash."
"Hello," said Everett, disconcerted. Was Moon his last name? He'd heard it before, and then remembered where. The Green at White Walnut. Moon was his name in Fog, apparently. "I'm sorry, your name is Harriman?"
"Right," grinned the bald man. "Harriman Crash. But you can call me Harry."
The woman glowered now. Everett and Harriman shook hands. Everyone paused to sip at drinks. Everett took the chance to tear off a corner of a roast beef sandwich from his plate and cram it into his mouth. Nobody else was eating.
"Excuse me," said Ilford. "I should play host."
He leaned in close to Everett.
"We'll talk later," he said in a tone of reassurance. "Harry knows a lot about your situation."
He patted Everett on the elbow and moved away. Fault trailed after him.
"So," said Harriman, still smiling, lifting his glass, "you're our new star around here. How do you like it?"
Everett was baffled. Dawn rescued him from having to answer.
"Don't be an ass, Harry," she said. "Everett doesn't know the first thing about it. He doesn't even know if he's staying."
"But you're considering working with us," Harry went on, intent. "Isn't that right?"
He managed to find his voice, but only to say,
"I'm not sure what that would mean."
"Very good. Neither are we. But it would be interesting to explore the possibilities. This is a time of possibilities, don't you agree?"
Everett couldn't argue with that. He said,
"I guess so far I'd been worrying more about, personal possibilities."
Harriman Crash shook his head.
"Same thing, especially for someone with your particular talents. Exploring one is going to mean exploring the other."
"You're being pretentious, Harry," said Dawn. "And moralistic." She lit a cigarette and Everett felt a pang. Did he smoke? Chaos had, anyway. He hoped that Dawn would offer him one. "Everett's idea of personal possibilities is much more interesting to him, I'm sure."
"Fair enough," said Harriman. "But he must also understand that his best chance of realizing them is with our assistance. His specialness has been more a plague to him thus far than a blessing. Isn't that right, Everett?"
"Had it been a plague?" He gulped down another bite of sandwich and said,
"I don't think it's that simple." "You're selling his sense of social injustice a little short, Don. Everett has been traveling, and he's seen, more than you or I or anyone else here, probably, just what the misuse or neglect of this sort of potential can mean. You left people behind in your journeys, didn't you, Everett? Probably in some pretty dire straits."
"Yes," he admitted, thinking, trying not to think, of Edie.
"Am I wrong to assume that if you could change things, here or elsewhere, for the better, that it would matter to you?"
"If I believed that..." What had Ilford been telling these people? What promises had he made? "But I'm not sure I do."
"Right." Harriman clapped him on the shoulder and grinned again, as though Everett had passed some test. "And so that's what we're here to show you, how you can. But let's do as Ilford said and talk later. I'm going to get another drink."
He went in the direction of the kitchen. Dawn had moved to the couch, where she sat looking bored beside another, somewhat older man who had gray hair and a dark mustache. Two other couples stood nearby talking quietly, working on drinks, and when Everett looked their way, they were quick to smile back at him. It was a room full of seemingly ordinary people, yet in the midst of the tapestry of disasters the world had become, it had a chilly, preserved quality, like a wax museum. He wondered if the cabal of leaders who ran Vacaville looked something like this before they transformed themselves into television stars and comic book superheroes. When he turned again, the mustache man and another woman had stood, and Dawn was making introductions. Sylvia Greenbaum and Dennis Ard were the new names, which Everett struggled to retain. Sylvia Greenbaum's eyes were bugged, and her full lips were slightly blistered. This, together with her explosive gesticulations, made Everett want to back away. She resumed a story.
It all came down to a tug of war between these two. Tree was this shambling old man. He liked to roam around picking mushrooms and talking to cows, just a feeble, eccentric old man. But he had us believe he was a German rocket scientist and that he'd blown up the world. We were supposed to feel all this guilt for him through the dreams, because he was so sure he'd caused it all to happen. And then Hoppington was in this cart thing, like a wheelchair, but he was young. She stopped and smiled shyly at Everett. Then the mustache man put his hand on her shoulder, and she was encouraged to go on. He was totally crazy, worse than Tree, and the two of them kept wrestling for control back and forth. Everett must have looked confused.
Sylvia's talking about West Marin, said Dawn. That's where she was before she came here. She's like you. She escaped.
It's probably still that way, said Sylvia. We were all trapped there for what felt like years. The most god-awful place, except Ilford was telling me you'd been to the one where everything is green. I still can't imagine that.
I've been to places worse than that, said Everett.
You mean where they're having that war with the aliens? Have you been there?
Not that one.
Dennis, tell Everett. Sylvia nudged Dennis Ard. At the same time, Dawn Crash looked at Everett, rolled her eyes, signaling exasperation, and slipped away.
I've been getting these dreams ever since the break, explained Ard, a little shy. From somewhere back east, I don't know where. They're the most degrading dreams about how I'm sick and worthless, diseased inside, and if I talk to anyone else or tell them who I am, I'll poison them too. I'll drag them down into this diseased, degraded world. I don't know why, I just seem to have a special receptivity to this awful dreamer, whoever he is, who's very far away. No one else has ever dreamed for him.
Dennis has been living here ever since the break, said Sylvia. It's not like he went out looking for this.
Anyway, it's been a terrible struggle for me. I wake up each day convinced I'm this awful, diseased thing the dreams say I am. I have to be told over and over that it's not true. I won't admit who I am or sign my name or anything else that might spread the disease, but you don't need to hear this.
He sighed heavily, looking close to tears.
The point is, it recently changed. When Ilford brought you back here, I started dreaming for you instead.
Ilford didn't bring me back, said Everett. Here was one point he was clear on. I just came.
There was a moment of silence, then Ard continued.
Anyway, it's the first rest I've had. I just wanted to tell you and to thank you.
You're welcome, said Everett.
I'm glad you're here, said Sylvia. I think the work you're doing with Ilford and Harriman is very exciting. Maybe soon you'll be able to do for West Marin what you did for Dennis.
I'm not exactly working with them yet, said Everett.
Dawn was back, tugging on his arm.
"Excuse me, Sylvia," she said. "I have to steal Everett here."
She steered him away towards a small study behind the stairs. He looked back with longing at his plate, but didn't resist. She pointed him to a chair in the darkened room and shut the door behind them, then ground out her cigarette in a tray on a small table. He sat on the thick carpet instead of the chair, and Dawn plopped down beside him.
I didn't mean to trap you with Sylvia and Dennis, she said. They insisted on meeting you.
You all want to meet me, he said.
Dennis tell you about his problem?
Dawn leaned in close to him, too close in the dark for him to read her expression.
You mean how he picks up the dreams?
Yeah. Did I tell you my theory about that?
Was she implying
that they'd spoken before? Was he supposed to remember her? He felt confused, but he put it aside. No. Well, the one who keeps telling him he's a worthless lump of disease, the one nobody else hears? Yes? I think it's his ex-wife. She laughed sharply. So there are dreamers here, he suggested. Well, there's you. This place can't be free of it. Everett thought of the fog surrounding the house, of No Alley's strange isolation in the city, and Kale. Kale's partial incarnation in his father's face and ghostly existence in Billy Fault's refrigerator. Take a look around you, said Dawn. We don't have to move every 3 days. We don't worship the television. This isn't Vacaville. Nobody planned this. You know all that from my dreams? I know about Vacaville from a lot of people. It's not that far away. Everett shook his head, trying to sort out his thoughts. He could hear the party going on, the clink of glasses, the murmur of voices. Planned things, bureaucratic places like Vacaville. Those aren't the only kind. Those are the exception. Christ, Everett, we're going to have to listen to Harry talk about this stuff. Dawn said in an exaggerated, sultry tone. We're going to talk about it all night. I just wanted to get a minute alone with you first. Okay. I find your dreams sexy, she said, her breath on his cheek. I just wanted to say that. Is that all right? Everett nodded. What do you think of me? She tilted her head away but moved her body closer. I'm reserving judgment, he managed. What? She said. Is this scene a little too much for you? I haven't been in that many scenes lately. Not this kind, anyway, he thought. I want to see you again, Everett, when we're not at a party. Can I ask that? Sure. She leaned over and kissed him, once, on the lips. At that moment, the doorknob clicked and a wedge of light shot across the small room. There you are, said Fault, grinning at them. Ilford's wondering. Ilford can wait, said Dawn. Fault sat down behind them. He didn't speak, just brought out a kit of syringes and a vial from his jacket pocket. Is that Kale? Asked Dawn. Everett just sat, open-mouthed and wondering. Fault raised an eyebrow. Why, you want some? Why not? She said. It's for Everett and me, said Fault a bit nervously. Only way I can take these little gatherings of Ilford's. Thought it might help him, too. Give me some. She stretched her arm out towards him, made a kittenish, pouting face like someone years younger. What we're proposing is very simple, said Harriman Crash. He paused for effect, and Dawn, on cue, sighed loudly. So far you've been operating at random. I can help you refine the ability to develop complete control over it. You want a dreamer, you mean? Said Everett. Here, in the one place there isn't one? Ilford started to speak, but Harriman raised a hand. Not so simply, he said. We're more responsible than that, Everett, as well as somewhat more ambitious. With your help, we'd like to create a broader coherence, a sort of viral coherence that would roll outward from here, reclaiming other territories, other realities. Of course, this would take time. How? We'd have to teach you to use your talent, make you visible to yourself, and to stay clear of entanglement with other dreamers like Kellogg. I thought you didn't have dreamers here. I thought you weren't worried about that. A talent like yours could awaken others, Everett, if we don't proceed carefully. Or it might act to protect itself from our tampering and turn us all into carrots or horseshoe crabs. Harriman laughed. I don't have that power, said Everett. I can't do what you're talking about. Maybe I change the locks on car doors, little things like that.
Consider letting us show you how wrong you are, said Ilford.
Consider saying fuck off to these vultures, said Kale from where he sat, perched on the back of the couch. Dawn emitted a shriek of laughter, drawing confused looks from Ilford and Harriman, and a panicked glare from Fault. Kale had appeared the moment Fault injected Everett and Dawn with the stuff from the vial. He stood in the room among them, visible, audible, real. "Hello, Kale," Dawn had said sardonically. Kale only snorted in return, then nodded at Everett and said, "Where have you been?"
"Don't talk to him in front of Ilford," said Fault anxiously. "Nobody else can see or hear him, but if you—"
Then Ilford had come in and hustled them out into the living room again to confer with Harriman Crash, and Kale had followed. Outside the windows, the fog was in darkness, and the living room again glowed as if it were the only room in the world, as if the furnishings were lit from within. Dennis Ard, Sylvia Greenbaum, and the others were gone. The party was down to its essential members. Now Dawn got up, rattling the ice cubes in her otherwise empty glass, and went into the kitchen. In the silence that followed, Everett saw that Ilford and Harriman were waiting for him to speak. Kale, behind the couch, seemed equally expectant. The gold clock on the table clacked softly.
"I want to know how it got like this," Everett said. "The dreams, the dreamers."
"There's a lot I could say on that subject," said Harriman, "but it would all be guesses, just interesting guesses."
"Self-serving guesses," said Kale, heard only by Everett and Fault.
"A gestalt urge for coherence after the rupture," Harriman went on. He fingered his heavy black glasses.
Everett suspected that if he moved them to another position on his bald dome, the watery, unfocused eyes would move with them.
"Forgive me if my speech lapses into metaphor. When the change occurred, the human need for order suffered a terrible blow. This great need resulted in the widening of a channel, a compensatory receptivity to dreams."
Dawn returned, her glass full. Kale leaned his head back, rolled his eyes upwards, put his thumb to his lips, and mimed gargling. Dawn just smirked and raised her glass to him. Everett tried to ignore them.
"People can't want to live the way they are," he said.
"Living under the regime of an eccentric dreamer may be better than suffering through the disjointed, amnesiac period that followed the disaster."
"And it might not be worse than listening to Harriman talk," said Kale.
Dawn snorted and spat out a mouthful of her drink. Fault immediately reached for a napkin and began dabbing at the wet mark on Ilford's couch. Ilford turned to her, puzzled. As Everett watched, an expression of throttled fury crossed Ilford's face, then subsided. Everett then noticed that Kale was staring at his father with a very similar look, but one that didn't subside.
"As in previous eras, the leaders are not necessarily those who are wisest or strongest," Harriman continued, oblivious. "They are the ones with a certain fixity of vision, and with the most comforting explanation for the disaster. That's the appeal of the conventional millennialism of your friend Kellogg. He struck all the traditional notes of sin and repentance."
"Like being stuck in a broken elevator with Bob Dylan," suggested Fault, giving up on the stain and tossing the balled-up napkin at Kale.
It passed through him and fell to the floor.
"You strike those notes yourself, Harry," said Dawn with false brightness.
"But all of this is neither here nor there," said Ilford testily. He appeared to be fighting some horrible battle to remain calm, almost as though he sensed Kale's presence in the room.
Everett wondered if he was the only one who noticed.
"There are lots of theories," Ilford went on, practically through gritted teeth. "Theories are like the disaster, different everywhere.
Last time Ilford got this worked up was when Vance came through here," said Kale, moving around behind his father.
"Interesting guy."
Everett tried not to stare. He hadn't seen Ilford and Kale this close together, unless he counted the way they mingled in Ilford's face.
"True enough," said Harriman. "Our emphasis should be on the opportunity."
Kale continued, talking over Harriman.
"Vance passed through here just after the change. You should meet him. He'll give you another point of view."
"How can I meet your friend Vance," Everett wanted to say to Kale, "when I can't meet you?"
"Only reasonable for us to want to protect our vision," Harriman was saying.
"Isn't it, Everett?"
"Get away from them so we can talk," said Kale.
"Look at him," said Don suddenly.
"Look at who?" said Fault, panicked, clearly thinking she meant Kale.
"Everett, that's who. He's exhausted, Harry. You and Ilford have to let him get his bearings, for Christ's sake. You're just bullying him with all this nonsense."
"Don's right," said Fault quickly. "I'm feeling a little wasted myself."
He sagged back in his seat on the couch, obviously relishing the prospect of an end.
"Don't say yes or no tonight," said Harriman. His expression was challenging, one eyebrow raised above the black frame of his glasses. "Just say that you'll sleep on it, so to speak."
"Okay," said Everett.
"It is getting late," said Ilford. "Let's have a last drink."
He spread his hands.
"Brandy?" He looked a little desperate, as if in another minute he might try to drink the varnish off the furniture.
Everett went outside, trailed by Don and the version or projection of Kale. At the very doorstep, they were cradled in fog. It clung to the eucalyptus branches and blocked out the night sky. Don lit a cigarette.
"I went to Gwen's room today," said Kale, hurrying, as if he was going to fade soon.
"Gwen is the woman in the dream, isn't she?"
asked Don, blowing out a gust of smoke that floated up into the fog. The question was directed at Everett. Now that it didn't matter, she acted as though Kale didn't exist.
"It's none of your fucking business, Don," said Kale, surprisingly loud. She raised her eyebrows and stepped away from them, but not so far that she couldn't eavesdrop. Or would Kale's words sound in her mind at any distance until the dose of him wore off?
"You saw her?" asked Everett. Kale nodded. "I spoke with her."
"You did?"
"She wanted to know when you'd come back."
It tore at him, unexpectedly sharp, to think of her there, asking for him. He wanted to object, to argue that she couldn't possibly experience any gap between his visits, that she didn't exist if he wasn't there himself, hadn't called her up. But to want that was to believe that she wasn't real, and that Kale wasn't real, that the two of them were only memories, waking dreams, and nothing more of them was left now. He couldn't believe that, couldn't let himself. Even as Everett thought this, Kale began to fade.